Nemoto presents Theater for Beginners. William Shakespeare, Drama as Cosmos. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 25 minutes. Theater for Beginners is your honest doorway into the stage where civilizations learn to think out loud. In each episode, one writer and one living question. Why does this still hit us in the chest? You'll meet the architects of drama and comedy from Athens to Edo to London. Aeschylus turning grief into law, Sophocles giving conscience a spine, Euripides dragging the sacred into the kitchen, Aristophanes laughing politics back to its senses, Zemi shaping silence, Shakespeare setting language on fire. You leave each episode with more than a plot. You leave with a tool, how to argue without cheating, how to spot a pretty lie, how to stand your ground without becoming stone. If you've ever felt theater was for other people, this is for you. One clear voice, rich storytelling, scenes you can see in your mind, and the quiet conviction that old plays are not homework, they're field guides for today. Imagine a king standing on a barren heath in the midst of a raging storm, his gray hair whipped by wind and rain as he cries out to the black skies above. There is no stage curtain separating him from the elements. It is as if nature itself has become his tormentor and only witness. This is King Lear, stripped of his crown and wits, railing against thunder as though the universe might answer for the injustices that have befallen him. In that harrowing moment, William Shakespeare reveals his conception of drama as something cosmic and profound. The stage is not merely wood and paint. It is a microcosm of the entire world, a place where mortal human struggles reflect larger philosophical truths. Shakespeare's theater makes the audience feel that human affairs are entangled with the very fabric of the cosmos. When Lear howls in vain at the tempest, we sense that Shakespeare is exploring the elemental forces of human nature and fate. And in play after play, whether tragedy, comedy, or history, he crafts stories that are poetic, philosophical, and universal, dramas that frame human nature in all its sublime and terrible complexity. William Shakespeare stands as a colossus in theater history, not just for the sheer beauty of his language but for the depth of his insight into the human condition. Born in 1564 in the small market town of Stratford-upon-Avon, he came of age during England's Renaissance, a time when old certainties about the cosmos were shifting. Copernicus had upended the idea of Earth at the universe's center, and the Reformation had challenged spiritual authority. Yet the prevailing worldview still imagined a divinely ordered cosmos. Every being had its place in the great chain of being, from God's angels down to kings, nobles, commoners, animals, and stones. Disrupting one's ordained place risked courting chaos. Shakespeare absorbed this belief in an ordered universe, but he was too keen an observer to ignore its cracks. His plays often begin with some tear in the fabric of order, a regicide, a betrayal, a soul out of balance, and then trace the ripple effects through both the human psyche and the wider world. In Macbeth, when the title character murders his king in the dark of night, nature itself seems to shudder. The next morning, an old man reports that the day is as dim as dusk, a falcon has been strangled by an owl, Duncan's noble horses went wild and ate each other. By violating the natural and moral order, Macbeth has unleashed something monstrous, and Shakespeare makes the audience feel it in their bones. This is drama as cosmic system. A bold crime against the rightful king tilts the universe off its axis until justice, or at least a grim facsimile of it, can be restored. For Shakespeare's audience, the boundary between the earthly and the supernatural was thin. He peppered his dramas with ghosts, witches, and prophetic visions that hint at forces beyond human ken. The ghost of Hamlet's father stalks the castle battlements at midnight, demanding his son seek revenge, leaving us to wonder whether it's truly a spirit of justice or a demon tempting Hamlet toward damnation. The weird sisters in Macbeth, with their cryptic chants of fair is foul and foul is fair, weave a thread of fate around Macbeth even as he exercises his free will in wicked ways. In Julius Caesar, a soothsayer's warning to beware the Ides of March, and a storm of omens, lions prowling the streets, the dead rising from graves, create an eerie sense that Caesar's fall is preordained by cosmic forces. Shakespeare used such elements not as cheap thrills but to engage with the idea of a universe that reacts to human deeds, a mysterious order in which the supernatural and the natural mirror each other. For the Elizabethans, the heavens could indeed send portents. And on Shakespeare's stage, a clap of thunder or an apparition is never just spectacle. It is a manifestation of the moral and metaphysical turmoil at the heart of the story. Yet if Shakespeare's vision of drama is cosmic, it is equally personal and philosophical. He wasn't interested in depicting abstract forces without also delving into the hearts and minds of individuals. His characters grapple with the big questions, fate, free will, mortality, morality, through their very personal dilemmas. Hamlet, the Prince of Denmark, wanders the cold corridors of Elsinore consumed by existential doubt. Is it nobler to suffer life's slings and arrows or to end one's heartache by ending one's life? He poses the question not as a dry academic, but as a young man tormented by grief and a paralysis of action. In that famous "to be or not to be" soliloquy, whispered perhaps to himself under the glow of a stage torch, Shakespeare merges the intimate and the infinite. Hamlet's private despair opens into a meditation on mortality that every audience member can recognize. Through poetry and character, Shakespeare makes philosophy visceral. When Macbeth, soul-sick at the end of his bloody career, speaks of life as a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing, it strikes us not just as a line in a play but as a raw cry from the depth of human disillusionment. Shakespeare's gift was that he could pen a line pondering life's meaninglessness and have it feel like it arises organically from a particular man's ruin, while at the same time resonating as a universal truth. The universality of Shakespeare's characters is one of the pillars of his enduring power. They live in specific times and circumstances: a Roman general tempted by ambition, a Venetian merchant facing a pound of flesh bond, an Egyptian queen in the throes of love and defeat. Yet they vault over those particulars to become reflections of all humanity. Take Othello. He is a Moorish general in Renaissance Venice, an outsider by race and culture, yet his fatal flaw is recognizably, tragically human: jealousy. When the green-eyed monster consumes Othello, leading him to doubt and ultimately destroy his innocent wife Desdemona, the audience witnesses how even a great, noble soul can be undone by an inner weakness. Othello's race or rank are less important than the painful universality of his insecurity, manipulated by the villain Iago's devilish whispers. Anyone who has ever felt the pang of jealousy or the fear of betrayal can see themselves in Othello's torment. Similarly, Juliet is a 13-year-old Italian girl from a feuding family, but when she stands on her balcony declaring, "My bounty is as boundless as the sea, my love as deep," every person who has known young love understands her heart. Shakespeare had an almost miraculous empathy that allowed him to step inside the lives of men and women, young and old, rich and poor, and make them speak from the core of their being. His characters are not pawns of a plot or mouthpieces of an ideology. They feel alive. Part of this is Shakespeare's refusal to make any character wholly simple or one-note. His heroes are flawed and his villains often carry glimmers of humanity. Consider Shylock in The Merchant of Venice. In the hands of a lesser writer, Shylock might have been a mere stock villain, the greedy Jewish moneylender. But Shakespeare gives Shylock one of the most famous speeches in the play: "Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions? If you prick us, do we not bleed?" In that moment, the supposed antagonist asserts his common humanity, challenging the prejudice around him. The audience is jolted into empathy for a man who was set up as an other. This depth of characterization was revolutionary. In medieval morality plays before Shakespeare's time, characters often represented one fixed idea, vice or virtue, every sin and every saint clearly labeled. Shakespeare instead created individuals of mingled motivations. His portrayal of Prince Hal, the future King Henry V, is another fine example. Across the history plays, we see Hal transform from a tavern-loving rogue keeping company with the drunkenly endearing Sir John Falstaff into a responsible, ideal king who coldly casts off his old friend. Shakespeare doesn't tell us what to think of Hal's action. He simply shows a multifaceted human being navigating the burdens of leadership. Audiences have debated for centuries: was Hal's rejection of Falstaff an act of necessary kingly duty or a betrayal of personal loyalty? The fact that both interpretations can coexist speaks to how Shakespeare's characters, like real people, are rich with contradictions. If Shakespeare's characters give his plays a beating human heart, his language gives them wings to soar into poetry. He had an unparalleled ear for the music of English. Writing mostly in unrhymed iambic pentameter, blank verse, he crafted lines that flow like living speech yet rise to the heights of metaphor and imagery. His words can be dazzlingly ornate or disarmingly simple, depending on what the moment requires. In King Lear, when Lear cradles the body of his beloved daughter Cordelia, his words stumble in heartbreak. Never, 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 never. Five desperate repetitions. No classical eloquence, just the raw pain of a father who cannot accept the permanence of loss. Conversely, in Hamlet, the prince greets his old friends with a burst of playful wit that turns existential. There is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so. This line encapsulates a worldview in a few crisp words, delivered as a casual epigram. And who can forget the lush, seductive imagery of Romeo and Juliet, where Romeo, upon first seeing Juliet, paints her as a source of light? Oh, she doth teach the torches to burn bright, or compares her to a winged angel gliding through the night. Shakespeare's metaphors often do more than decorate, they reveal how his characters think and feel. Macbeth's guilty conscience summons a hallucination of a bloody dagger leading him toward his dark deed. Later, his despair at his wife's death comes out as a haunting metaphor for futility. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow. Through such imagery, Shakespeare's poetic language deepens our understanding of a character's soul at that moment. Astonishingly, in pursuing such poetic depth, Shakespeare also expanded the very English language. He coined or popularized hundreds of words and phrases that have entered everyday speech, from "all that glitters is not gold" and "break the ice" to "a foregone conclusion" and "heart of gold." His inventive turns of phrase and imaginative metaphors stretched English to new expressive limits. Even people who have never read Shakespeare unknowingly quote him, a testament to how deeply his language has permeated culture. He also had a keen sense of when to abandon verse and let characters speak in prose. Often, lower-class characters or comic moments unfold in plain prose to sound more natural, whereas kings and lovers often voice their thoughts in elevated verse. This shift itself became a storytelling tool. A mad King Lear raving in fractured prose starkly contrasts with the stately blank verse he spoke as a sane monarch, mirroring his descent into chaos. Through such nuances, Shakespeare's dialogue not only delights the ear but also reveals character and mood. For centuries have passed, and while some archaic words might puzzle modern ears, the emotional truth and beauty of Shakespeare's language remain as potent as ever. Yet, for all the high poetry, Shakespeare never forgets the groundlings in the pit, the common folk who paid a penny to stand in the Globe Theatre and watch. He mixes the lofty with the earthy, not only to appease a diverse audience but to reflect the full spectrum of life. In Hamlet, right after the gravely philosophical "to be or not to be" scene, he inserts the bumbling comic relief of Polonius, the verbose old courtier, bringing the prince news. Hamlet gleefully mocks Polonius with puns and absurd non sequiturs. "Do you know me, my lord?" asks Polonius. "Excellent, well, you are a fishmonger," Hamlet replies nonsensically. This humor coming on the heels of existential angst isn't a flaw in construction. It's Shakespeare recognizing that life's profound and ridiculous elements are intertwined. In tragedies, he often used comic relief to heighten the pathos by contrast. The drunken porter joking about the effects of alcohol just after Macbeth has committed a horrific murder, or the clownish gravediggers in Hamlet bantering about their trade as they unknowingly dig Ophelia's grave. These juxtapositions make the tragic moments hit even harder. Like lightning flashes, a moment of laughter brightens the stage only to reveal the gathering darkness more starkly. And in comedies, Shakespeare frequently wove in moments of sincerity and reflection amidst the silliness. In Twelfth Night, the antics of mistaken identity and foolish suitors pause when Viola, disguised as a man, speaks quietly of her yet unspoken love. She never told her love, but let concealment, like a wormite bud, feed on her damask cheek. Such poignancy amid the farce gives Shakespeare's comedies a human depth. Shakespeare's understanding of dramatic structure was intuitive and remarkably effective. He largely followed the five-act structure that was standard in his day, but within that frame he orchestrated the rise and fall of action like a master composer. His plays often build tension through a series of cause and effect beats. In a tragedy like Othello, it's the handkerchief, a simple prop that, once planted by Iago in the wrong hands, triggers Othello's jealous rage. Scene by scene, Shakespeare tightens the noose. We see Iago's insinuations taking root in Othello's psyche, the hero's trust eroding, his language shifting from calm reason to wild, broken exclamations as jealousy devours him. By the time Othello resolves to kill his innocent wife, the audience is internally screaming for someone to intervene, but the momentum of tragedy is unstoppable. That is Shakespeare's devastating structural logic. In his comedies, structure often takes the form of a tangled knot that gradually gets unraveled in the final act. A Midsummer Night's Dream, for instance, begins in a world of rigid law, an Athenian father demanding his daughter marry his choice under pain of death, then plunges into the freedom and chaos of an enchanted forest where fairy magic causes lovers to swap affections and an amateur actor to gain a donkey's head. Shakespeare juggles multiple threads: four lovers, feuding fairy royalty, a group of comic tradesmen putting on a play. Yet by dawn, as the lovers are discovered and the spells lifted, all conflicts resolve in marriages and reconciliation. The chaos is mastered into harmony, and the final act's joyful wedding celebration doubles as a kind of comic catharsis. Shakespeare's audiences left the theater feeling that order, both social and cosmic, had been restored, if they had watched a comedy. And if they had watched a tragedy, they left with cathartic tears, having witnessed order restored but at great human cost, as when Fortinbras takes control of Denmark at the end of Hamlet, or Malcolm becomes king after Macbeth's tyrannical reign is ended. Either way, Shakespeare knew how to satisfy, or at least profoundly move, the expectations of his audience. Among Shakespeare's works are also his history plays, a genre he made uniquely his own by blending epic chronicle with deeper questions of leadership and legitimacy. These plays, like Henry IV, Henry V, and Richard III, dramatize the lives of England's kings, and on the surface they celebrate national history. But Shakespeare uses them to probe what makes a good ruler, and whether moral authority flows from divine order or personal virtue. In Richard II, the king believes himself God's anointed, sitting secure on the great chain of being. Yet his misrule leads to his deposition by Bolingbroke. When Richard II is imprisoned and realizes too late that kingship is just a human title that can be taken away, he muses on the fragility of human greatness in a prison soliloquy that strips the trappings of majesty. "I have been studying how I may compare this prison where I live unto the world." Shakespeare invites the audience to pity Richard's fall while also understanding why Bolingbroke, who becomes Henry IV, seized the throne. The history plays often present this ambiguity, the cosmic idea of the divine right of kings clashing with the practical realities of power. Prince Hal's journey from rebellious youth to King Henry V, culminating in the rousing St. Crispin's Day speech at Agincourt, shows an ideal of kingship formed through adversity and self-reinvention. And yet, even in the triumphant Henry V, Shakespeare gives voice to common soldiers on the eve of battle questioning the moral burden a king bears for the souls of his men. There is always that philosophical undercurrent. These may be plays about England's lineage of monarchs, but they are truly about human nature under the testing ground of power. They show the pageantry of history while slyly reminding the audience that kings and clowns alike are part of the same human story. In Shakespeare's conception of theater, then, all the world's indeed a stage. He uses the stage to reflect the world back at itself in multifaceted ways. He frames human nature as something constant yet infinitely varied. Circumstances change: ancient Rome, medieval England, enchanted islands, Renaissance courts. But people love, hunger, scheme, laugh, and mourn in ways that transcend time and place. He is often called a poet of nature for this reason. Nature, in the sense of the innate qualities of humanity. And he investigates those qualities from every angle. Twelfth Night revels in the foolishness of love and pride. Julius Caesar dissects honor, ambition, and the malleability of public opinion. Measure for Measure questions justice, mercy, and the letter of the law. The Tempest contemplates forgiveness, art, and mortality. In The Tempest, believed to be one of his final plays, Shakespeare's cosmic imagination reaches a gentle zenith. Prospero, a magician duke who has orchestrated the play's entire plot on his mystical island, chooses to forgive those who wronged him and renounce his magic. When Prospero declares, "We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep," it is Shakespeare speaking through his character, hinting at the ephemerality of life and art. Prospero even breaks the fourth wall in the play's epilogue, asking the audience to free him with their applause, as if Shakespeare himself were bidding farewell to the stage. The lines blur between creator and creation, between the staged illusion and the truths of life. What makes Shakespeare particularly accessible even as he waxes philosophical is that he anchors cosmic ideas in human experiences everyone can relate to. Take the notion of fate versus free will, a grand philosophical debate. Instead of lecturing on it, Shakespeare personifies it. The star-crossed lovers Romeo and Juliet are fortune's fools. Accidents of fate constantly thwart their plans, yet it's also their impetuous, youthful free will that drives them together in secret. In Macbeth, witches prophesy Macbeth's rise to power, hinting at fate's design, but it is Macbeth's own ambition and his wife's that propels him to fulfill those predictions in the most bloody way. Thus, Shakespeare suggests, perhaps fate presents chances but humans choose how to meet them. Or consider the conflict between reason and passion, another age-old philosophical theme. In Antony and Cleopatra, Mark Antony is torn between his Roman sense of duty and his overwhelming love for Cleopatra. His reason tells him to return to Rome and his duties as a triumvir. His passion binds him to Cleopatra in Egypt. This tension ultimately leads to his ruin, but in the process Shakespeare treats us to sumptuous poetry that almost vindicates passion over cold reason. Because who could resist such love? Even in defeat, Antony's final words are, "I am dying, Egypt, dying," merging his identity with his beloved. Shakespeare doesn't offer a simple moral. He lets the complexity stand. His plays rarely preach. They pose questions and leave the audience to ponder. Shakespeare's ability to capture human nature also owed much to his life in the theater, a bustling, communal enterprise. As an actor, he trod the boards himself. Tradition has it he played the ghost in Hamlet and Old Adam in As You Like It, among other roles. He was also a shareholder in his theater company. This hands-on experience meant he understood what works on stage, what moves an audience, what makes them erupt in laughter or fall into stunned silence. His dramatic instinct was impeccable. He often begins scenes in the middle of action or conversation, in medias res, hooking viewers quickly. He allows his characters to talk about offstage events vividly rather than always showing them. This not only saved on staging difficulties but engaged the audience's imagination. Consider how battles in Julius Caesar or Antony and Cleopatra are often described by messengers rather than depicted. Shakespeare also mastered pacing. He knew when to let a scene breathe and when to accelerate. Consider how Hamlet alternates high drama, the play within a play catching the king's conscience, with quiet introspection, Hamlet's solitary musings in the chapel scene where he spares the praying king. This gives the audience emotional ebb and flow. Ultimately, what Shakespeare achieved in his body of work was to create a poetic and dramatic system that encompassed the whole of human experience, almost like a great imaginative cosmos unto itself. His theater framed human nature by placing people in extreme circumstances, be it tragic or farcical, and revealing their essence. Under his gaze, a lowly gravedigger philosophizes as profoundly as a prince. Fools speak wisdom and wise men act foolish, love can be as maddening as grief, and a single character can contain contradictory truths. There is a famous anecdote that Shakespeare's rival Ben Jonson paid tribute by saying Shakespeare was not of an age, but for all time. Indeed, part of Shakespeare's genius is that while his work emerged from the specific conditions of Elizabethan England, its cosmic beliefs, its language, its social hierarchy, he transcended those conditions. He tapped into elemental human truths with such accuracy and beauty that his plays remain fresh and meaningful centuries later, across vastly different cultures. To watch or read Shakespeare is to confront ourselves, our capacity for great good and profound evil, our moments of whimsy and our depths of despair, our need for love and our abuse of power. And he does it all while entertaining mightily, weaving ghost stories, drunken antics, lyrical love scenes, sword fights, wordplay, and wrenching reunions into an unforgettable tapestry. In Shakespeare's dramatic cosmos, each play is like a star in a constellation, burning with its own light, but together they form a picture of humanity against the backdrop of the universe. 400 years on, we still gaze up at that constellation with awe, finding new patterns, new meanings, and reflections of our own lives in its arrangement. Shakespeare's stage may have been local and wooden, but his vision was boundless and human to its core. Through the universality of his characters and the poetry of his language, he indeed made all the world a stage, and on that stage we continue to see ourselves, illuminated by the flicker of his genius.